Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
The winds of change are blowing. There's excitement in the air. Can you feel it? It's electric and magical. The happy train's on track because America is back.
Boyd wants it himself. Oh, what a goal! A ripper from Tyler Boyd, his second of the night. One of the real bright spots tonight for the U.S.
America is back.
Boom! Yes. Caught offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh,
What's up, brother?
From sea to shining sea, Andrew.
Oh.
Those diagonal balls floated all the way from the West Coast to the East Coast.
You know,
spreading good cheer amongst all soccer fans.
It's wild that this is the first truly competitive match since the night of nights.
616 days.
Oh, my God. It does not feel that long ago.
But in many other ways, it does. Because when you're halfway through a friendly against Peru or Ecuador and time is dragging.
It just reminded me, though, like I couldn't help but go back. So this is how we're starting the podcast now. We're happy the U.S. won. We're playing cheery music. Do you remember? Here's the opening of that podcast. I went back and I actually found it from how that one started. So we can think of where we were then and how we feel right now.
Oh, wow.
We've done a lot of these podcasts.
We have.
This is the one that I didn't... Literally, if you and I were doing this show from now until the end of time, I'm not even trying to be overly dramatic. I truly thought that this podcast that we're about to do would never happen. We were at such a loss for words that night. We couldn't even believe what we were seeing. We sat here quietly for 20 minutes and then finally decided to actually do the podcast. And that was 616 days ago. Jeez.
But tonight, a new ball rolled.
America is back. We will talk about a lot of things on this podcast tonight. Of course, we are here at 12:15 a.m. Eastern Time after the U.S. played Guyana.
Because we felt we needed
because
to.
Because we felt like we needed to do this, the first competitive match since that day. So we'll talk about that, the game that we just watched, of course. The U.S. women defeating Chile 3-0. We're going to recap that. A lot of other kind of like random happenings around the world, including Pogba and Lukaku, Neymar. So really, actually a lot to get to. So let's get right into it now. Like I said, why we're here. Kind of a post-match recap between the U.S. and Guyana as the U.S. begins their Gold Cup quest to defend their Gold Cup crown. And they get off, I would say, mostly on the right foot. A 4-0 victory. Good scoreline, I suppose. It kind of had to be. Not to like go back to being arrogant, but I don't know.
It was Guyana. They had to qualify for the competition, which is pretty much at this stage, particularly in the group stage, a who's who of honeymoon destinations.
There you go.
And they beat Belize to get here. They are a team that consists a smattering of pros, a lot of semi pros. You know, Pittsburgh Riverhounds are represented there. Also Reading, so a good team,
yeah.
A good level of team. But the prevailing sense was that we needed to go out and win, and we did, and there were bright spots. There were also the recurring themes that regularly get thrown in our faces. And Berhalter said at the start of the game, Andrew, we needed the 3 points and just get off to a good start in this tournament with a good feeling, particularly after the last two friendly games, and it happened. So we shouldn't...
Yeah, they needed the 3 points, but honestly... You know, beggars can't be choosers, but 1-0 was not going to cut it tonight. I think
no, but
on the heels
of
two ugly friendlies and a lot of questions from a fan base that is, let's be honest, we've been on Twitter. We see what people are saying, even when things are going well. This is a fan base that is very New York Met-like, I would say, just in love with its own sadness. So 1-0 wasn't going to cut it. 4-0 feels about right to me. It could have been more than 4-0, but by the same token, it possibly could have been less. Jesse Zardes' goal was unusual, probably rated very low on the XG scale, I would think you would have to say.
Expected face goals.
Yeah. Let's start from the very beginning here. I don't really have too much to say about the lineup. I didn't find there to be all that much shocking about it. Maybe you thought you'd see Matt Miazga tonight, but Walker Zimmerman playing instead of Miazga doesn't really move the needle much for me. The only thing, Zardes starting up top instead of Jozy Altidore, I don't believe that that actually has anything to do with how Berhalter rates the two players. I think that's more of a fitness thing for Altidore. I think Berhalter's making sure that Jozy is right at the end of this tournament rather than overusing him at the beginning of it. I think he probably felt tonight was a night he could get away with not necessarily needing to play every single one of his A squad players.
Lima in a wide position, Pulisic occupying a wider position too. Mm-hmm. Tim Ream playing at left back again, which is like wallpaper for Berhalter. I do not believe that will prove itself to be a good position for Tim Ream, but tonight it was fine against Guyana. Look, the things that were good tonight, the things that worked, we saw a really good performance from Tyler Boyd, I thought, and he was inventive, he was quick, he played some good passes, he released wide players, he got involved in the play himself, he scored two great goals. You know, it was a good performance. Areola too. Those were good performances.
Definitely the two standout performers.
Yeah. Bradley was okay. Played a lovely ball for...
Had the assist on Boyd's first.
On Boyd's first goal. That was good. Do we see any progression in the playing between the lines, building out from the back style? No. Walker Zimmerman in particular. What's demanded by this formation, Andrew, is that... people like Zimmerman can step into the midfield and play passes between the lines. He looked terrified every time he tried to do it. Michael Bradley didn't look pretty comfortable doing it either. We're still the same team in that respect. Even against minor opposition like Guyana, we're not going to be cutting you open with prescient passes and razor-sharp deliveries. But out wide, I thought we were good, and we created some good chances, as we should against a team that are... nowhere.
Yeah. I think for me, Boyd is really the big story that comes out of this game tonight, just because, you know, in everything that we've seen over the last year and a half, you know, the importance of bringing young players along, which we've done. You know, Pulisic obviously already had come along, but Adams, McKennie, obviously those two are your standout ones. But, you know, Boyd wasn't even on the radar. Like, he makes this switch in nationalities from New Zealand to the U.S., and it's like found money in your pocket, like when you put on a winter coat from last year and, oh my God, I had left a $20 bill in here. Like, all of a sudden, Tyler Boyd has now appeared and is a key figure who's starting these games in the Gold Cup for them and scoring goals. And now, like, just like that, not to overreact, but he was the best player on the field tonight. You know, him or I guess Pulisic or Areola, one of those three. But you give Boyd your man of the match tonight and feel pretty good about that, I would think.
It's funny, in the Venezuela debacle, his set pieces look really, really good. And he's had a good half season in Turkey, which you got to give credit to the scouting department that he was on the radar and they got this change done swiftly, and in he comes. Look, he looks like a starter for me in a team, yeah, in a team that is, if Pulisic isn't firing or is being man-marked or marked out of the game, especially against better opposition, he's a good player to have. But yeah, it was a result that I'm glad that they got the four goals in, because look, it doesn't, you can watch this team and you can clearly see the issues that still remain, the problems that are still there. Landon Donovan made the most prescient point of the night. In terms of tempo, the tempo wasn't great, but really Landon's point was more to what I've been talking about forever, and I will not stop beating this drum. Pressurizing a bad team like that,
yeah,
trying to force mistakes and creating quick transitions. Why are we not doing this yet?
I couldn't agree more, and that's what I had written here for what I didn't like tonight. I thought Landon Donovan was spot on when he said that at halftime.
If not
tonight, when?
Yeah, and this isn't hard. This is something you can use against the bad teams and the good teams. It requires coordination in terms of, right, when Zardes presses, say the ball's on the right back for Guyana has the ball. Zardes goes to close him down. Okay, so you have to think, where do the other pieces go? Where does Pulisic go? There's a tandem. There is a pattern to it. But it's not hard. Mm. It requires the fitness, the running, the aggression and the spirit that we would believe that are staples in a US team. And I just think it's the easy part for Berhalter to do, and I'm not seeing progress on that side.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I would agree with that. I think the other thing, this is a minor knock if we're like really digging and looking for criticisms tonight, but one thing for me, I thought at least at the start of the game, Guyana looked a little too comfortable. In the first couple minutes, it was pretty much all in the Guyana attacking end of the field. Now, the U.S. did respond quickly. In the third minute, you had a good run from Boyd, and he played on a really good ball where the U.S. just couldn't finish. So, you know, the U.S. did turn things around, but I don't know. Conceding an early goal is kind of a thing that the U.S. has become, you know, they'll allow that a little too easily. It didn't happen tonight, but against a better opponent, to allow them to be that comfortable on the ball in the attacking third, it's a little bit of a worry.
Yeah, and
maybe a minor one.
Three corner kicks in the first half was too much.
Yeah.
You know, but again, that was an intensity thing, Andrew. You have to bring a pressing style. You have to harry and hassle these players and show up their technical deficiencies. And as Landon pointed out, we didn't really do enough of that in the first half.
Yeah. But overall, I'd say it was more good than bad, which is the hope in a game like this.
Well, the real bad is McKennie walking off holding his hamstring.
Well, he was both ends of the spectrum tonight. He was good and bad. He played in the nice ball to Areola for the first goal.
Right.
He had a couple of those. Even before the first goal, he had another through ball that the U.S. just didn't finish. But, you know, he was doing some of the things that you'd want him to do. A couple giveaways in the middle third, which, look, it's going to happen. These guys are not... No, these aren't perfect players.
No,
they're going to make some mistakes. But obviously, and like I said, we're recording this just after the game. So by the time you're listening, you may know what the diagnosis is on his injury. We don't yet, but it looked like he grabbed his hamstring, and that's not good. And that's the kind of thing, even if it's only minor, you know, does it keep him out for the remainder of the tournament? Maybe. Kind of like nagging muscle injuries, hamstrings, calves. I don't know.
Is he straight back to Germany for treatment so he's right for the start of the season?
Maybe. You couldn't. It'd be hard to fault him if that was the course of action that they decided to take.
Especially considering he's really only just back from injury in many
ways. I know, but that's frustrating because this was a tournament where we wanted to see Adams, McKennie, and Sargent. And now there's a better than average chance that after the first game, we're now not going to really see any of them for the remainder of the tournament. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not still interesting things to watch. Like I said, Tyler Boyd has just become a really, really intriguing figure on this team. You know, Pulisic is always fun to watch. He's worth the price of admission right now for the U.S. Not seeing those three players in this tournament, young players who are building blocks for the future, it would have been nice for them to have some international tournament experience, and we may not get that now.
In an area of the field that, like me and you were always talking about, we need to be better. We need to be more dominant. And it's disappointing. And we are a diminished side without two of our German rising stars. Not good.
No. Another thing that I didn't really like tonight, JJ, a couple years ago, I remember watching a game and hearing the crowd chant, "You can't do that."
Oh, no, you got to give me, and you can't do that.
And I remember really kind of getting on American fans saying, we're better than this.
You cringed so hard, you almost swallowed your face. Your face went in. It was so bad.
Yeah. So after I heard that, I thought, well, we've now reached the bottom in terms of chanting as a fan base.
This is the end.
But tonight, we challenged that notion, I thought, just a little bit with this.
And Trapp have been the other two to have played in every game.
Leading Guyana in the first match of a Gold Cup, I think at the time it was 2-0, and the crowd chanting, we're top of the table.
It sounded like 7 or 8 guys, but it was audible, very audible.
A stadium full of people, all in unison, screaming,
we're top of the table.
I think once again we have to say that you
said,
we're better than this.
You said... It's amazing how organized and how excellent the American Outlaws are, but you made the point we don't have any songs.
Well, I think we need more songs for individual players, because without that, we wind up in a situation where we're doing this. And no one wants this, really.
Yeah, and also be a little bit self-aware. You know, it's Guyana at home in your first game.
Actually, it might have been 3-0 at that point.
Equally.
It doesn't help.
It doesn't really help.
Yeah, we need songs for individual players on a more regular basis.
Yeah.
I think that would cure a lot of these ills.
Yeah, these are simple formulas. You could have Tyler Boyd is magic. He wears a magic hat. And when he transferred to the US on a one-time transfer, we said we fancied that he could have played for New Zealand or America. No, he could have played for New Zealand or some other team, but they're he plays for the USA because we're dynamite. Oh, Tyler, you know, something along.
There you go. Yeah, look at you. It took 2 seconds. You just wrote a song.
Yeah. Beautiful. Well, it's the Tony Pulisic magic hat song.
Overall, I don't really have a ton else to say about this game tonight. There was...
It's not prudent to talk too much about it.
I mean, how much really can you take away from...
Diagonal passes. I thought at times our ability to get in around the back with a long driven pass was very, very good.
I think you'd have to say more than at times. It seemed like that was generally the strategy tonight.
But doesn't that seem like a departure? Because that's essentially a very good long pass. But it got us up the field quickly. It put them on the back foot. And it's something we can do.
Yeah, and the encouraging part of it was they can do it because so many of those passes were directed towards Areola, who I thought showed a great first touch throughout the course of the night on a lot of those long balls.
Very true. And also, it creates that width that Berhalter always wants. And, you know, you can get runners off the ball then. They don't have to necessarily cross it in, get runners from deep. I'm clutching at straws here. I'm trying to,
that's
know.
What this is all about.
But
why we're here.
I mean, I'm talking about diagonal balls against Guyana. Okay.
My favorite narrative of the night, if we were talking about just narrative destruction, the Giassi Zardes first touch narrative. Because one of his first touches in the first half was a goal. Now it was offsides, but it would have been a goal.
By accident.
Granted, it was by accident. And then another one of his first touches literally turned out to be a goal. Again, possibly by accident, but that's just a mere footnote.
Remember, last week it was. I talked about in the mailbag, you know, Christianity, Catholicism. Can I talk about when I used to go to Mass as a kid? Because you're there as a kid and you hear all the hymns and all the responses. Mm-hmm. And they were your screensavers then. You heard them so much. As a kid, you'd hum them, right? It was just right there, imprinted in your brain. You heard it so much. When I watch this US men's national team, Twitter becomes the hymns from Mass. Here's one of the hymns. Sardis first touch. Sardis first touch. Sardis first touch. And here's another one. Bradley, you... Michael Bradley, stop playing for this team. They're so repetitive. You right?
JJ, when their lineup was released, I don't know why, what compelled me to do it, but I just went on Twitter and in the search box I typed in USMNT lineup.
You maniac.
And like a punch in the face, instantly, it's like 100 Michael Bradley hate tweets. And you just want to say, what is wrong with all of you people? What did he do to you that causes you to feel this way about him? I'm sorry, everybody. He's just not as bad as you say he is.
No.
He's just not.
He might be in a period of his career where he's okay. He's just okay. He'll give you that brilliant weighted pass to Boyd, but he also might play a pass that's a bit risky and it doesn't work out. Or he might play a square pass that you don't like. But it doesn't matter.
They all do.
Yeah.
They all do.
Hey, we're not that good. Right now, we've got some decent young players coming through. We've got a world star or very close to that in Pulisic. But, you know, we've got a lot of average too.
I hope this doesn't get me in trouble saying this. I love American soccer fans, obviously. I am one of them. I love how much the fan base cares. But sometimes I feel like U.S. soccer fans confuse snarkiness with intelligence. Like, if I say something really sarcastic and snarky, it's going to make me sound like I know more.
Right.
And, like, I just don't subscribe to that. Like,
no, they are all...
It gets old and tired to me.
I do feel like there's guys sat with their beer watching the team. And I'm not sure that the entire part of their soul wants the U.S. to lose.
Because they want Michael Bradley to make some, like, crippling error in the middle of the pitch that causes to a break the other way that leads to a goal. That's what I said at the start of the podcast. There's an element of the fan base that is in love with its own sadness, that's waiting, like, can't wait for the next error. We got to get past that. We got to get on board and really get behind this team.
Yeah,
come on, people.
It's a self-loathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hardly and look, it's not without some warrant. Like,
we've had our sorrows.
Right. We understand. I mean, you and I tonight, the way we were reminiscing, they showed Berhalter on the sideline, and in the background for a millisecond, Omar Gonzalez's face appeared. And it sent you and I off into like a 10-minute reconstruction of his own goal against Trinidad.
I got out of my seat to do it.
We reenacted it. Yeah. So, like, we all have that in us, but I don't know. Sometimes the snarkiness on certain American soccer narratives, it just gets boring to me. It just does. I think there's some things we got to move on from.
And another refrain is, Greg Berhalter comes from MLS. What did you expect?
I'm enjoying this character.
We're going to go to mass, me and you, someday.
So that's our look at tonight's game. Obviously, the next game is against Trinidad. We will be back on Thursday with a little bit more of a look ahead to that one. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very quick break, JJ. When we come back on the other side, we have another victory to discuss, and that is for the U.S. women and their defeat of Chile. Like I said, also some other things in the Women's World Cup. Pogba, Neymar, Maurizio Sarri, all kinds of things still to talk about. Don't go anywhere.
Everybody back for Chile as Dalkemper floats one up. It didn't go to press. Blasted! What a goal for the U.S. Ronnie Lloyd. A record goal.
Oh, Carly Lloyd. A record goal. Indeed, she becomes the first player to score in six straight World Cup matches. She also became the oldest player to have a multi-goal game at the World Cup, which is interesting to me because she doesn't... I know she is, in sports terms, an older player, but I don't know. I still don't like look at her and be like, oh, look at that aging star out there. Like, I feel like she's as good as ever.
She's not like one of those flabby heavyweights who just needs one more pay packet.
Right.
Like she still is deadly. And the way she took her goal as well, how sharp was that? You know, a little snap volley into the net. I know, but we have, I said before, if you can avoid injuries and look after yourself, the old paradigms of age can be messed with, and she is messing with it.
With the first goal she scored, I'm telling you, it took me like eight replays to finally see that it was her that scored it and not Julie Ertz. It's one of those moments where I'm so relieved that I'm not announcing the game, because I think I would have screamed Ertz. And it's why JP, the Hall of Famer that he is, he knew to take a moment before he said the name, because he thought,
you don't want to get it wrong.
There's two players around the ball, so let my spotter make sure that we have this right. So there's probably like a 6 second delay before he actually says Carly Lloyd.
The best thing you can do is just go, and then give yourself that moment. Give it the Barry Davis breathe time. I'm sure Barry Davis did that all the time.
Of course. It's smart. Honestly, it's a smart tactic for a broadcaster to use. Let's talk about this game, JJ. A 3-0 victory for the U.S. women. They've won their first two matches in this tournament by a combined score of 16-0. That is actually not the most ever. Norway in 95 won their first two 17-0. I'm going to now be that guy a little bit here. It seems like it's become a rule in this Women's World Cup that we have to find things to be angry about when the U.S. women play. So I guess we'll start on that end. I didn't have a problem with this, but some people were not thrilled with Jill Ellis making seven changes from the 13-0 win. Were you one of those people?
Well, I was, because I texted you and I thought, that's a lot of changes. But it was more a cautionary worry. Is that going to upset rhythm? Really, what it showed was, and showcased, the depth of player it also, you know, it keeps the squad happy to give those some of those players 90 minutes. Like, if you look at how Kristen Press played in this game, the idea that she would start on the bench again against opposition that the US had scouted, knew they were going to beat, it would have been wrong. And so Ellis got it right. Also, look at look, for example, at Davidson. She played so well against Chile. Like, look at her set pieces, her driven corners. She's a superb striker of the ball.
She's 20?
Something like that.
Yeah.
But to know that she can come in and contribute, she deserves to play too. And the problem is we have such depth that there's a lot of people on that team, like McDonald as well, who came in and I thought controlled in the midfield pretty well. You know, they deserve to get a run, and this was prime time to do it.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, rotating the squad to keep players happy, along with rotating the squad simply to keep what you deem to be your first team fresh, like,
great idea.
Why not do it? I think it was Stu Holden who said on Twitter, because he was seeing a lot of people questioning why they were doing it, and he said it made, I think it was him who said it made total sense, just that this was probably going to be their last chance to keep their certain players fresh on this team in a tournament where they believe they're going to go deep. So, like, what's the harm? There's very little drop-off from one player to the next.
Well, here's the harm in the sense that, well, there isn't any harm, but we are conditioned by the World Cup. It just wouldn't happen in the Men's World Cup. It's very unlikely, unless it's the final group game. You know, in the middle of the group for things to be in jeopardy. So we're conditioned to think, oh, bad move. But the US have Chile scouted. They realize that they are an inexperienced side. They're not a side that are going to cause them any problems. And it was the right time to do it, and she got it right.
Yeah. One other negative before we get to the positives. Again, grasping at straws a little bit, but Alyssa Nair hasn't been asked to really do much in this competition so far. When she was in the first half, with Chile in a position where they could have tied it, she kind of, in that ball that was sort of in no man's land, she sort of shied away from it, wound up going in, but it was brought back on an offside. So it wound up being no harm, no foul. But I think we have so few moments to actually look at this goalkeeper so far and make any kind of judgment. That was one of the few, and it wasn't a great moment for her necessarily.
No,
but again, like, it was clearly offside, so I'm not ready to like make some sweeping judgment based on that.
No, but just looking at it, she looked hesitant. She doesn't seem to like the ball over her center backs, in between her center backs and herself. Maybe that's something Sweden might look at. Drop balls in behind her, force her off her line. She's not quick, she's a little bit hesitant. But again, it was the first thing she had to do in close to 120 minutes of action. So that's not easy either.
Yeah. Now on to the good stuff. This is the more fun stuff. JJ Carly-Lloyd, I guess maybe she's playing with a chip on her shoulder.
Do you think?
Well, she basically said before the tournament, when it was made clear that she was not going to be a starter for this team, that she accepts the decision from Jill Ellis, but she's not necessarily okay with it. She still believes that she should be in the first 11. And like, how can you not? It's hard not to agree with her. When you watch her play, she's excellent still.
Yeah, but I wouldn't. I mean, that's starting.
Well, the problem is, who are you taking off?
That starting triumvirate, I wouldn't mess with. Because as good as Carly-Lloyd is, there's more movement in that. That would be my view. And it's going to discomfort defences more than she is. Because she's not quick. She's not going to run in behind. Nearly every one of those three can do that. That would play in her stead, or potentially. Why can't... Here's the thing. She's a veteran. She can make huge impacts off the bench, as we've seen in the opening two games. She could be an excellent jailbreak against the really good teams, or the teams that will sit deep. I think she should not accept the role, because you always want to play as much as possible, but realise you're going to see significant minutes, and also you're going to see significant moments, because when you come in from now on, I would say from now on, when Carly-Lloyd, when the board goes up and she knows she's going in, it's because the US needs something. And that's good.
Yeah. Here's what Kate Margraf, she was a former U.S. defender analyst now on ESPN FC. Here's what she said. She said she agrees with Ellis keeping Lloyd as a sub.
The way in which the U.S. plays, Carly-Lloyd is a very good nine, but her as a nine It's not a build-up playing nine. It's a, I'm going to go and attack, and I'm going to be a target and a weapon on set pieces. There are plenty of other weapons as well that can fulfill that same role. So collectively, it seems from what we've seen from Jaleel, she feels like the team is better as a whole with everyone performing rather than having Carly Lloyd in the lineup. But I always say, imagine being on the other team as an opponent, and all of a sudden Carly Lloyd comes in off the bench. I don't care who you are. And as a former defender, you're like, oh, dear God.
Yeah.
And that, my sentiments exactly.
Yeah. Also with the U.S., I thought set pieces, which are always so important in these tournaments, they look really good so far through these first couple games.
Ertz reminds me of Shane Duffy attacking
set
pieces.
What a header.
Yeah, it was a brilliant header.
Oh, my God. Great header from her. And then Carly Lloyd later on for her second goal, the way she attacked it in the box, it's something that they're going to be great with. And this isn't a game where, you know, Megan Rapinoe's not even playing, who we know plays in a great ball on free kicks. So
look at the first, the Ertz headed goal, and think about the power that was on that, because Endler got a hand on it and it still didn't matter. And think about the amazing game she had. She pulled off one of the best saves you're ever, like, they kept the U.S. scoreless in the second half. Think of, it was almost like a Gordon Banks save down to her right-hand side. She clawed one out. I mean, Kristen Press will be seeing her in her nightmares.
She must have been, what else do I have to do?
Because
to score
she could have
her?
Scored a hat-trick.
Yeah. Yeah, Kristen Press was brilliant. Unfortunately, it didn't show up in the score sheet, but what a game I thought she had.
She just met a brilliant goalkeeper. And by the way, one of the debates that's been raging over the last week or so has been the debate about making the goals smaller for the women's game, when it's really like, okay, no, what you're going to do is you're going to recruit taller goalkeepers and train them up. And Endler is a classic example of that. Why would you make the goal smaller for her? It's impossible to get it past anyway.
Yeah. Ultimately, through two matches, it's hard to take too much away because the competition with Thailand and Chile is not, it's not necessarily what they're going to face later on in this tournament. However, like, they look brilliant so far. They've been great.
But let's match them up against what we've seen. Look at France. France have been playing, a kind judgment on France is that they've been playing within themselves. Now, Henri, Le Sommet, Renard has not impressed me as much, but those attacking players are brilliant players. But they have not looked a shadow of what the US are. The US look like the class of this tournament right now, and we shall see whether that continues.
Yeah. Where do you stand on this idea that, like, the England model from the Men's World Cup, this idea that the U.S. should consider losing to Sweden to give themselves an easier, a quote-unquote easier route through the tournament? The answer is don't do it.
No, first of all, the Southgate model was something that was presented by the fact, like, if they put a full team against Belgium, like, and they both duked it out, there's a chance that, you know, Belgium are a better team than them, you know. My view of that is, it's not in the DNA. And I'm not, by the way, or to our English listeners, I'm not saying the DNA of Gareth Southgate's England is to lose. But what I would say is that the DNA is certainly not for this women's team to lose. Look at the way they trampled over Thailand and trampled over Chile in that first half. They don't, and if you ever hear them talk, we're going to go out, we're going to crush you, and then when we're done crushing you, we're going to crush you again. Like, they are all about winning.
A couple things. First of all, they can't do it.
Don't, like, knock them off their rhythm.
I mean, and when I say they can't do it, I mean they literally
don't
can't.
Know how.
But not even that. England could do it because, you know, when you looked at England's squad, they have, their A team. And then there's players on there that you could rotate in and say, okay, this guy may not even play in this tournament, but whatever, we'll play him against Belgium because we don't really care if we win or lose. The U.S. women don't have those players. Like, we just talked about the depth, seven changes that they made. Like, there is no B team on the U.S.
Also, the point should be that the U.S. women are expecting to win the tournament.
That's the thing.
The English team got to the second round and needed penalties. It's not like they beat Colombia 2-0. They had to beat them on penalties.
Right. Now, look, I know Brazil didn't go on and win the World Cup, but just for the sake of comparing, you know, like, the way Brazil are viewed in the men's game, that's the U.S. in the women's game. All right, Brazil in the Men's World Cup are never going to do that. They believe that we're Brazil and we're going to beat everybody. I don't care who it is. That's how this U.S. women should feel. This women's team should feel. Like, they shouldn't be afraid of any opponent. There shouldn't be any route to a World Cup final that they would look at and say, ooh, let's do what we can to avoid that. Teams want to avoid them. They're not the ones looking to avoid other teams.
And, I mean, England still went out to Croatia in the semifinal.
But in the end,
the longer term aim is for the U.S. women's national team to win the whole thing.
Right. And look, I hope I don't sound like a hypocrite because I was...
You always do.
Well, but I was somebody who was beating the drum that England did the right thing.
Oh, yeah, you did.
But like I said, the U.S. women are not like comparable to England in the men's game. This is the U.S. women are a more dominant team than England are in the men's game. England have to look out for things like that to get the most favorable draw. The U.S. women don't. So this was from Martin Rogers at Fox. He wrote this about a conversation he had with Tobin Heath. He says to her, people have spoken back home about it's better to finish if it's better to finish first in your group or second. I said after Sunday's 3-0 win against Chile, your team is all about, and Tobin Heath jumped right in, finishing first. We don't have any thoughts like that. We want to take each game and win each game. That's the mentality, and that is what it should be. I think it's almost silly to even to think anything other than that. One other note on this before we move on to a couple other Women's World Cup notes. So much of the headlines around the U.S. women has been this legal battle that they're fighting with U.S. soccer over equal pay between them and the men's team. Mm. This came out in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, which I found to be very interesting. It says the U.S. women's national team generated nearly $51 million in revenue, mostly from ticket sales from 2016 to 18. In the same time frame, the U.S. men's national team generated just under $50 million. In ticket sales, in game sales, the U.S. women actually earned more money in that three-year window than the men did. Now, there's a lot more to this legal fight than just that, but I would think that is interesting for people to see that.
It is interesting, but the broader point to all of this is, and this is why perhaps the U.S. women's national team are imperfect messengers. I was reading something by the midfielder McDonald that came on, who was the only member of that squad with a child. And she thought about quitting the game when she had that child. And she tweeted today, but someone had asked, why would you even think of quitting the game? And she said, because it's pretty hard to raise a kid on an NWSL salary. So the first team players, the names, the Tobin Heaths, we've seen the deal they've done with Hulu. We've seen the deal that a lot of the players are with Gatorade, Mallory Pugh, the faces. They, because of that, get to garner a lot of extra revenue in to compensate for what is not appropriate pay, in my view. I do believe in equal pay, Andrew. But the real challenge is for U.S. soccer, just like we discussed on this podcast before, when we were talking about the 30 for 30 document, the real challenge is for them to fund it properly so McDonald doesn't have that decision to make, so that right at the grassroots level, the fullback for the Thorns or the Pride can actually pay their way, can actually have a proper full-time professional career out of this. So it's interesting, you know, ticket sales, let's be equal with the men. It's got to go further. It has got to get down to the league structures as well.
Let's see, elsewhere in the Women's World Cup, I shudder to bring this up, but you know, it's just the way that it is, JJ. The big conversation over the past couple of days has once again been VAR.
VAR is for everything, though. VAR is for everything. If a cop pulls you over tonight for running a red light, they're going to send it to a TV camera in Zurich. It's going to be VAR reviewed. Sorry, they've completely lost the run of themselves with this thing.
Wendy Reynard of France was allowed to retake her penalty after the Nigerian keeper Chiamaka Ndozi was judged to have moved off her line too soon. I'm afraid to ask you, of all people, this, but what are your thoughts on this incident?
So a penalty in the game is supposed to advantage, the advantage is supposed to be with the attacking team, because there has been an infraction. There's your penalty, there's your free kick at the goal from 12 yards. Mm-hmm. First of all, I thought the heel of her left foot was still on the line.
It wasn't.
It was close, but it wasn't. This is too molecular for me. I think it's too molecular. Letter of the law, that should be retaken. What about the encroaching players from France?
Well, I do have the answer for that.
Right. Okay. So look at all these things. I think it was too molecular. I think Renard missed her chance. That was it.
Ultimately, I agree with you. VAR, as was my understanding, is supposed to be there to rectify clear and obvious errors.
Yes.
Now, you're right. From a molecular level, as you say, did they get the decision correct? Yes, they did. Her foot, both feet were off the line prematurely. But was it clear and obvious?
No.
Not to me.
But everything's up for VAR now. And what is it over? Is it half the penalties have been VAR reviewed or more than half, I would imagine, at this point? It just feels like if there's an incident in the box, it goes to VAR, it's going to be a penalty. It's too much.
Here's what one of the underrated stars of this tournament so far has been Christina Uncle for
she's great.
Fox, who's been kind of like the replay review person, like the referee analyst. Here's what she said about VAR's intervention in the France-Nigeria match.
There is still irrefutable evidence that she's off her line by the time the kick is taken. With that said, VAR must recommend this down for the referee to take a look. And actually, it's a factual review, so the referee doesn't even have to go to the monitor to take a look at this. So that's it. And then going to your point on the encroachment by the attackers and defenders, they've had quite a number of questions with respect to that. Under the VAR protocol, when it comes down to goals, it comes down only, the VAR only gets involved in that significant play if they become directly involved in play in that point. Here, there is no, so another referee's not going to go ahead and go move forward with that. But we're breaking it down. At the end of the day, VAR is really restricted to the protocols, and that's how it gets involved in the play.
So she answers the encroachment there. If had there been a rebound and one of those players sure. scored, then it's VAR. But right. because they're not involved, it's not reviewed.
It's ruining. It's too much, man. It's getting involved in everything, and it's look, people like you wanted it, and this is your new world. This is your utopia.
Don't be like that, you condescending piece of garbage.
Demolition man.
I do want it because ultimately I think there's too much at stake. Ugh. And you got to make sure that what is correct gets ruled out there.
I can't do this again. It's 10 to 1 in the morning. We can't.
Really? Because I'm up for 12 rounds, baby. By the way, congratulations to Marta scoring her 17th World Cup goal. She becomes the all-time leader in World Cup goals for both men and women, passing
Miroslav Klose.
Very good.
There's a lot of
one, lot, but you're still on your game.
A lot of men out there upset with that. They've been on Twitter. No.
What are you talking about?
Oh, it's the men's World Cup record and the women's World Cup record, and never the twain shall meet.
All right, well, then say whatever you want.
A lot of culture wars happening on over this World Cup.
Well, Marta did score. And
no, she didn't.
She now has 17. She now has 17 World Cup goals, so props to her on that. And one other note, Sam Kerr earlier today for Australia scored 4 goals. She came into this tournament being hyped as in the conversation for best player in the
sure.
world. And she's doing a lot to justify that. Her 4 goals, I don't even think she realized how important they were. After Brazil had scored to go up 1-0, Australia then needed in their game to get that 4th goal. And when Sam Kerr scored it to put them up 4-1, she said she didn't even realize the magnitude of that, but it actually moved Australia into the second place line from the third place line. So they get into the round of 16 automatically now, rather than having to kind of be nervous to see which third place teams would get in and which wouldn't.
Did she tell anyone in the post match to suck on that this time?
That was probably quote of the tournament so far.
So suck on that.
Good for her. Let's see. We've got a couple transfer things to get to. Oh, but first, JJ, I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter. What if you had your own personal recruiter to help you find a better job?
Be so sweet.
Well, now ZipRecruiter's technology can do that for you.
Just get rid of you, first of all.
Why? Why do you have to go to such a mean place? You can't just let me talk about a good product like this. Just download the ZipRecruiter job search app. Let it know what kind of jobs you're interested in, and its technology starts doing the work. The ZipRecruiter app finds jobs you'll like and puts your profile in front of employers who may be looking for someone like you. If an employer likes your profile, ZipRecruiter lets you know. So if you're interested in the job, you can apply. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated job search app. And based on a third-party survey, 7 out of 10 people who found a new job on ZipRecruiter increased their salaries. And these were results of a 2017 U.S. survey of over 500 ZipRecruiter users who got hired for a job that they found on ZipRecruiter. Now, listeners to this podcast should download the free ZipRecruiter job search app today and let the power of technology work for you. Don't wait. The sooner you download the free ZipRecruiter job search app, the sooner it can help you find a better job. Very cool, ZipRecruiter. You do fine work. Find people, ZipRecruiter. I know every single one of them.
Nice way to slide into transfer rumors.
Yeah, these are people that are, I guess you could say, looking for a new job, only because they want to, not because they need to.
And with Raiola Recruiter.
Well, we start with Paul Pogba, JJ, who now is saying he wants out of Manchester United. Here's his words directly.
After everything that happened this season, you know, with my season, for me, it was my best season as well. I think for me, it could be, can be a good time to have a new challenge somewhere else. I'm thinking of this, to have a new challenge somewhere else. Yeah.
After everything that happened.
Could you hear him well enough there?
Yeah.
He said that he thought this was his best season and that now after everything that happened, he wants a new challenge somewhere else.
Well, statistically, he had a good patch, but if anyone thinks he's overperforming or performing to anywhere near his ability.
I'm sorry. Like, I'm not saying he was bad for Manchester United, but who's walking away from the season he just had saying that's a Real Madrid player right there?
Waiting you here. Guy on Instagram. Nice kid.
Uh-huh.
Says he's a Man United fan. Sounds more like a Pogba fan.
Uh-huh.
Trying to convince me that Real Madrid's midfield with Modric and Kroos and Casemiro needs a Pogba in there. They'd keep the ball, says he. They'd be dominant in possession. I didn't respond. There was nothing to say to that. I mean, because he seems like a sweet kid, but no. The last thing you need, a midfield that was routinely hacked open by Real Betis or whoever, Levante last season, is to have Paul Pogba added to it.
Yeah.
Casemiro would die of exhaustion doing all the running for him, you know? Kroos has stopped running. Why would you bring in another guy who's going to saunter around?
Unless you think that Zidane can get more out
right.
of these players.
Right, and unless you're going to rejig the midfield in general and the rest
of
the team.
Well, which they probably will do.
Well, they've done so much spending already, you're wondering where the money's going to come from.
I would like to talk about that.
300 million.
That is the other side of this. It's not just about whether or not Pogba wants to leave Manchester United. And by the way, we're only assuming Real Madrid is the intended target here. I've seen Real Madrid as the primary one, but I've also heard Barcelona. I've also heard a return to Juventus for him. But let's assume that Real Madrid is what we're talking about with Pogba.
Yeah.
So like you just said, they've spent nearly £300 million since the end of last summer. Hazard could exceed 150 when it's all said and done. Luka Jovic, 53 million. Ferland Mendy was 47. Edgar Militao was 42. 18-year-old Rodrigo was 40 million. But this is from the BBC because we talk a lot about financial fair play and what it actually means and what teams can or can't do. BBC says this: an analysis of Real's financial figures suggests that they have the capacity to spend more. In their last set of accounts, Real had income of 751 million euros, and while they were knocked out relatively early in the Champions League in 18-19, other income streams such as friendly matches and commercial sales are more than likely to make up the shortfall. While Real have spent considerable sums this summer, the club also banked a 100 million euros from the sale of Ronaldo to Juventus last summer, which will appear on this year's accounts.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Sam Wallace of The Telegraph tweeted this. At the end of April, Real Madrid's magic money tree is in bloom again and they're linked with Pogba, Hazard, et al. The et al have arrived. But their half-yearly financials for 18-19 are out and the figures don't lie. They need to sell players to raise cash. That was his Sunday column on April 28, 2019. You can go and read it.
That's what he says?
According to Sam Wallace, they have nada, zip, nothing.
He says they have nothing?
Yep. It was baffling to him how they would be able to pay for these players. And it's going to be very...
Well, I just read the numbers for you. Real had income of 751 million euros.
He contests.
So he just doesn't believe their figures?
Well, who am I to...
I'm not going to call him a liar.
I hate the fact that the article is behind a paywall, but I heard him discussing it. I hate it. But yeah, he contests that. But also, it's a wild amount of money to have spent already. You know?
Well, here's... I mean, look, there's another side of this. Their squad is too big right now. So guys are going to be leaving. There's just no way around it. It has to happen. Whether that means Bale, whether that means Isco, I don't know. But there's just no way that they're going to be entering the 2019-20 season.
Bale's going to play golf. Bale is going to stick it out, ride it out, play some golf, play whatever Welsh internationals.
Why does he want to do this? Why does he want to waste away the final years of his prime on a team that doesn't want him?
Sorry, you've seen Goodfellas.
His wages will be tremendous wherever he goes. Yes, I've seen Goodfellas.
You pay me.
I've heard the line.
Right. Do I need to repeat it?
No, that's all right. with the whole financial fair play thing, people do ask us all the time, what does it actually mean? So I do think it's important to at least read this to people. Again, this is from the BBC. Financial fair play rules are designed to ensure that the amount clubs spend on their players slash wages is approximately equal to what they earn in commercial revenue slash prize money.
Yep. That's it in its basic form. But you can see up and down the leagues in England how that's not working out with teams like Bury, mm-hmm. Boulder Wanderers just going to the wall. Charlton even.
Yeah. Yeah, Charlton I was reading this week are...
crazy
it's,
stuff.
It's getting really, really ugly. They released a statement because they're not going to bring back...
They're blaming Lee Bowyer, who took them to the championship, blaming him for asking for too much money. Basically saying, if Lee agrees with what we offered him, then he'll be back. If he doesn't, and even though it's a minute amount of money compared to what some other championship managers are on.
Yeah.
It's about £200,000 sterling a year, it comes to. And their owner was on TalkSport, you know, defending. I mean, the club is... The fans are in open unrest against the owner, even though they have been promoted.
Yeah.
The financial fair play has been a great idea in theory, but its enforcement across the board, even at the top level, has not been...
It's been really limited.
Yeah.
Let's see. We stay with Manchester United for a sec because another prominent player may want out as well. This one's not entirely as clear, but there's talk about Romelu Lukaku wanting to leave and wanting to leave for Inter Milan specifically. He recently called Antonio Conte the best manager in the world, who is now Inter's manager. He said he's always wanted to play. It's always been a dream of his to play in Serie A. Now, remember, Manchester United paid $90 million for him 2 years ago. Like, what kind of... Now, I know there's massive inflation in this sport in terms of what players are sold for now. How much of a loss... Like, they have to take a loss on this, right? Lukaku's coming off a season where he's underachieved. He's a little bit older now, obviously, than what he was when they got him. He'd be going, if he does go to a Serie A club, or Inter Milan going to spend the kind of sum that you talk about other Premier League clubs being able to spend because of what they get through TV revenue?
Inter have always had a penchant for the wild transfer, and this would be right up their street. But you're right, it's unlikely they'd be able to pay him wages-wise. Maybe they can incentivize his contract in some other fashion. But, I mean, it's not close to an equal paying level as Manchester United or the Premier League. I don't know how this wizardry, this witchcraft would happen, but Inter would be a club with that kind of transfer, that splashy transfer in mind.
Just seeing stuff like this, Pogba, Lukaku, we've talked about this so many times before, but if you look at the marquee players and the marquee signings that Manchester United have made, just...
It's such bad business in
that none of these guys have increased their value from when United got them. Every player on this team, with maybe the exceptions of Marcus Rashford, maybe I'm missing someone else, but that's the one that jumps to mind. They've all gone down in value.
But look at what they're doing with Wan-Bissaka. Like, one season. Now, I know he had a difficult evening for the English under-21s who lost out to France, unluckily, 2-1 in the under-21 European Championship. But... just look at that performance. He's had one season. He looks very quick. Technically, we're not sure if he's 100% there, but, you know, he has room to develop. And United are making these bids, Andrew, these huge money bids to get him into the club. And it just seems to be that Crystal Palace are... we'll keep pushing United all the way because we know they'll pay. We know they'll do it. Now, I think Wan-Bissaka is probably a better move than some of the other moves they've made in the last few years. But... if you look at what Solskjaer has done in getting in James, the young player from Swansea, get them young, get them early. United scouting needs to be revamped because, honestly, the bigger clubs see them coming and they just push prices up. United need to be in the strength position when they're making these transfers. And that means, Andrew, they have to talent identify at smaller clubs.
The problem for Solskjaer is, do you really believe... that he's going to be given the time to mold young players?
Probably.
Like, as it is, United's board are probably like, wait, why did we hire this manager when we did, when there were other possibilities out there for us? So he's already on... Is he on borrowed time already? So he's not going to be given a chance
to work in young talent.
So he has no choice. He's kind of managing for his job already. He's got to make marquee signings.
Which is the boom bust cycle that they're working on. Spend a load of money and then go bust when the manager.
Right.
And it's what's happened since Van Gaal. It's happened all the way. Sorry, since Moyes. Moyes. Hey, David, can you rebuild it? Not going to get the time. Splurge. Can't get all the transfers in you want. Bad handling by Woodward. Out. Van Gaal. I mean, Van Gaal was executing transfers from the Moyes era. Moyes wanted Ander Herrera for so long, and then Ander Herrera arrives, and you're not sure that Van Gaal even wanted him.
Mourinho probably would have been given more time had things not become so toxic.
Yeah, things had gotten... The results were so bad. The dressing room culture was so just awful. He probably would have got a bit longer, but...
Yeah. We continue here, JJ. 2 years ago, Neymar was transferred to PSG from Barcelona for 222 million euros. And now there is talk of him possibly leaving. You talk about Pogba and Lukaku taking losses for United. Oh, my God. What are PSG going to sell Neymar back to Barcelona for? Half that cost? This could turn out to be unbelievable business for Barcelona in the end. Get Neymar back and probably have, in the end, gotten like a 100 million euro bonus with it.
But the warning signs were there. If you read Miguel Delaney's piece in The Independent and also the piece on ESPN FC about Neymar and his lifestyle habits, we had Graham Hunter on this podcast 2 years ago before the transfer went through when he said he told us he didn't feel the transfer would happen, but he couldn't rule it out. He also talked about how Barcelona had become concerned about the lifestyle, the sudden jetting off to Brazil at the drop of a hat, the way he was conducting his off-the-field business. And that has just come to fruition and come to pass. Can't think of the last time he put in a performance that would be warranting of the claim that he's in the top three players in the world along with Neymar and Messi, or along with Messi and Ronaldo.
Yeah. Well, here, there is one thing that's easy to forget with Neymar because of the real cloud that has followed him for the last season plus. He did score 49 goals in 55 competitions last season between the league and the Champions League. So it's hard for me to look at that player or not.
Oh my God. Not, no one is saying that. What I'm saying is, though, that it is easier, it appears to be easier for him to, execute on the field in the French league and still leave this double life in Paris. Apparently he's taken to Parisian nightlife as well. That's all problems that have followed him from Barcelona.
There's a couple of things I found interesting about this, one of which from ESPN FC today was very interesting for me. So we look at Barcelona right now, and we hear things, some of the veteran players may be annoyed with like an Ousmane Dembele and immaturity issues. Well, Neymar is kind of like the poster boy for immaturity issues for marquee players.
Do you remember at the Champions League parade in 2015? He was acting the goat on top of a bus or something, and Xavi was there scolding him.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's why this report from ESPN FC was so interesting to me. I'm reading now from the article. One reason Barca are now contemplating bringing Neymar back is because key players desire to have him back in the dressing room, according to a source. The Brazil international remains good friends with Barcelona stars Lionel Messi and Luis Suarez in particular.
He's still in a WhatsApp group with Messi and Suarez. They have their own group chat since he left.
This is the role that Neymar needs to be in. I know he wanted to leave because he wanted to spread his wings and try to get a Ballon d'Or for himself. Look, it's going to be almost impossible for him to do that at PSG, and he probably should have recognized that in the moment. But even still, I don't think he is suited to be the face of a team or the leader of a team. I think to be in an environment with veteran leadership like Messi and like Suarez, players like that, Pique, Busquets, like that's the right atmosphere.
Rakitic, they're all his seniors.
That's like the right kind of environment for him to be in. To have players like that who can almost, almost be a shield to him for criticism, for performance. Like, I just feel like Barcelona is just more the right fit for Neymar. He tried to do it at PSG, and it's just not right for him.
It's too easy to forget how absolutely brilliant he was at times for Barcelona in that front three, in that MSN front, front three. And also, I think Coutinho, with Coutinho not working out, Barcelona are probably going to have to take a loss if they move Coutinho on again. So it's probably all going to even out some ways in the wash. But maybe Coutinho goes to PSG. Maybe I've heard that there's huge interest in England about bringing Coutinho. But
and really, as there should be. He's really shown an ability to thrive there.
Yeah, there's only so many places really these top players can go these days in terms of money and in terms of staying within the remit of financial fair play. Very interesting.
Yeah, this one is just the thought of Neymar going back to Barcelona. Now, one possibility is he would go back to Barcelona on about $112 million, and players would also go back PSG's way. Rakitic's name was one that I saw. Umtiti is another one.
Yeah.
And Usman Dembele was another one. So one or more of those players could go back as part of an exchange to bring Neymar back to Barcelona.
That balancing act for Barcelona, considering the precarious position they are in, needs to be done right as well. I wouldn't be just ready to let the like a Rakitic go.
It is amazing, though, with Neymar. Like, you talk about a guy in the midst of a truly awful stretch. Much of it his own doing. But just, like, think of from the moment that he got hurt and missed the Champions League, then punching the punch-out that he had on the steps of the cup final in France.
Yeah. It's been one thing after another.
Name in the papers, obviously, for the rape accusation, which we talked about. Injured his leg, forced out of Copa America. And then
the video of him being nutmegged by the young Brazilian player and then him just
pulling him down,
kicking him.
But then the chairman of PSG, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, basically calling him out this past week, saying that no one has forced Neymar to sign here. Almost like he's almost pushing Neymar out the door, questioning his commitment to the club.
Andrew, this is a club under investigation by UEFA. This is a club that has the eyes of the world on it because of its Qatari, basically being owned by a country that has problems in the eyes of the Western world and the rest of the world. The last thing they need is the spotlight of this guy acting the way he's acting.
Yeah, should be fascinating to follow that. One last one to get to, Maurizio Sarri. He has left Chelsea for Juventus. And it now appears that Frank Lampard could become the new man in charge. It seems that is Chelsea's top target. If that is to go through, is that a good move for Chelsea?
No, it just seems to be kind of reeks of the sentimental attitude that has befallen Manchester United and bringing Solskjaer back. Look, I watched Derby a lot last season. They had one of the biggest budgets in the Championship. They barely scraped into the playoffs. Frank Lampard was consumed by the duel with Leeds, and that was a brilliant second leg, but they were pretty roundly beaten in the final by Aston Villa, who did not play well. And he made some really, really poor decisions in picking Tom Huddleston in midfield alongside David Johnson, and then having Ashley Cole at left back as well. There was a lot of decisions where I'm like, this isn't going to work. Your midfield's going to be overran. He had an okay time in the Championship. Okay. When you balance out budget and results. That is not a massively compelling CV to then send him into the hot seat at Stamford Bridge.
With a potential transfer ban
looming,
being upheld for Chelsea, which I'm going to assume at this point will be upheld. You know, it's...
No, can I just say this quickly? Yeah. In his time in New York, I was lucky enough to speak to him four or five times. One time at length. Very cerebral, thoughtful guy. I think he can be a very good manager, but God, he needs more time than this.
I just can't help but continue to think that Sarri got a raw deal at this club.
Oh, yeah.
The fan base, just for whatever reason, they just never clicked with him. If Frank Lampard, who they adore, if he walks in and has literally the identical season to what Sarri just had, wins a Europa League, gets to a League Cup final, finishes third.
They'll rename the King's Road.
Oh, my God.
The Lampard's Road.
And by the way, let's say that they play just like the same style. If Chelsea fans want to call that a boring style that they played last season, let's pretend it's the same style. I mean, like, they will polish a statue of that man outside if there's not going to be one of him already. Sarri could not have done a whole lot better than what he did while he was there.
Again, they took a turn on him in the middle of the season, and that was it. And they got fixated on Jorginho. They got fixated on Sarri ball, which Sarri said, well, I don't call it Sarri ball. It's not my style of play. My style of play, we're not even playing my style of play right now. You know, yeah. I just think that was a really good season last season. Also, the biggest departure of all, the thing that changes everything, is that Eden Hazard will not be there.
I know.
Their talismanic force, their creative force, the guy who, you know, in terms of assists and goals, was everything to the club, is not there. And you're asking essentially a rookie manager at this level to come in and to maintain, not get better, maintain what was reached last season by an experienced manager of over 20 years. It's a lot to ask.
Yeah, and it's a big thing to take on for Frank as well. Look, he's going to live on in Chelsea lore forever. He'll be beloved there no matter what happens. But, like, he's a legend at that club, and it can dent a legend quite a bit if you go back to a club and things don't go the way fans hope or expect them to go.
Yeah.
That can be a sad thing for Lampard to potentially have to face.
How sad and unpleasant to watch would it be to see, you know, Stamford Bridge turn on Frank Lampard?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not a club that gives a lot of time. Now, again, I do think there's factors that work in his favour here. He's a club legend. Abramovich, I don't know what is happening with this project now. This is the day we all dreamed of, folks. The day we all dreamed of since 2003 when he bought the club and all the money came in. Oh yeah, but wait, they'll go back to being rubbish when Abramovich is gone. Well, we don't know what his involvement is right now. We don't know how hands-on he is.
Yeah.
Frank Lampard may get more time than most.
And finally, JJ, a very quick what to watch for. Women's World Cup. There's a lot of games of importance, scenarios and things, but really, I'm only going to give you one game right now, and that is Thursday, 3 o'clock, the United States and Sweden. It's very simple for the U.S. women. A win would see them finish top of the group, in which case they would face Spain in the round of 16. If the U.S. loses, they will face either the Netherlands or Canada in the round of 16. No matter what, their knockout stage game will be on June 24th. A couple things here when I look at that. For the whole conversation that we were having before, which again I think is nonsense, but the idea of whether or not the U.S. want to lose to give themselves that easier road to avoid France in the quarterfinals, which is how it would play out right now because of France's win the other day. I mean, let's look at these round of 16 matchups. Do the U.S. really want to face the Netherlands or Canada in the round of 16 if they were to lose? Okay, so you avoid France in the quarterfinals going down that road, but your round of 16 match probably gets a little more difficult than if they're facing Spain.
I don't think they'll fear anyone. And
you're
that's
right.
That's why they're
you're
happy right. to keep going on the route they're going.
Just and, win, baby.
Yeah, and I do think, honestly, right now, if they were to play France tomorrow morning, the U.S. are winning it. And that's their mentality. And they should just stick with it.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I'm with you 100%. So we'll be back on Thursday with a recap of what happens in that USA-Sweden match. We'll have a 5 stars, 5 years memory of the week for you. Red cards, man of the match. We'll look ahead to the USA Trinidad Tobago revenge match.
Yep, we'll also have Sky Sports, who have created a show that is tailored to annoy me and you. It's unbelievable. We will play the trailer from that with appropriate wailing sounds.
Yes. So this was fun. It was nice to actually watch the U.S. in a competitive match where we like feel some feelings.
I just feel relief. It's over. We are now back playing competitive football, and it's good.
Yeah.
I would say, hallelujah.
Hey, to you I say, that's right, my friend. Have a good one.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.